First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
A rash of hate messages spark fear, outrage, and action after the city's biggest tourism weekend of the year. Good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 2. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, leaders speak out and condemn anti-Semitic messages displayed over Florida-Georgia weekend. We'll tell you what they're doing to condemn hate and make this city safer. You can call us up right now. It's 549-2937. Join us. Also, with early voting already underway, new polling is out this week on the closely watched sheriff's race and the city's mayor's race. And a little spooky fun for Halloween. Yeah, today's Halloween. That's later in the hour. But first this morning, hate messages splashed across the city of Jax this weekend, rattled the Jewish community, rattled all of us, and drew condemnation from local and statewide political leaders. Here's what happened. First, anti-Semitic banners went up along I-10 and the Arlington Expressway. Then, during the Florida-Georgia game, more hate messages. They were projected onto TIAA Bank Field and a downtown high-rise. After a weekend of fear and anger today, local faith leaders say they are harnessing outrage into positive action. Joining us now in studio, we welcome Miriam Feast, CEO of the Jewish Federation and Foundation of Northeast Florida. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. And folks, did you see the hideous, vile display of hate messages displayed around the city over the weekend? What are your thoughts about how we in Duval County in North Florida can condemn hate and anti-Semitism? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Facebook open as well. Well, Miriam, unfortunately, this made national news. These anti-Semitic hateful banners displayed on highway overpasses, and then light displays literally put on the outside of TIAA Bank Field and a downtown high-rise that read, "Kanye is right about the Jews," referencing a message from the rapper Ye, the former Kanye West, who has come under universal condemnation for his anti-Semitic outbursts in recent months. Can I begin by asking you, what's your message to people who are just seeing this and finding out about this, and they're shocked and they're appalled?
Well, it would surprise me that anybody would be shocked and appalled. What's happening just in the last couple of days has been trending in our country and internationally for the last number of years. The rise of anti-Semitic rhetoric and hate crimes have been significantly on the rise. I think for people that I speak to who live here in Jacksonville, it's shocking because people just don't think it happens here, but it's happening everywhere. And so our message is, now is not a time to be silent. Now is not a time to be passive. And now is not a time to engage in a dialogue with people who don't want a dialogue. Rather, harness this energy, harness these emotions of fear and anger and sadness into action. Let's do something to combat this talk, this hate talk.
It was encouraging to see leaders speak out against hate. Mm-hmm. Everyone from Congressman John Rutherford to Mayor Lenny Curry to gubernatorial candidate Charlie Crist, Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried, Shad Khan, the owner of the Jacksonville Jaguars, also issued a statement condemning this hate. Can you tell us what the Jewish Federation is doing to combat this hateful trend? Because you've been very busy and you have a lot of news to share.
Thank you. Well, actually, our work around this started over a year ago. So this just illustrates the importance of our work and the timeliness of our work. We're trying to deal with this in three different ways, three pillars. One is safety and security. Two is education, and three is building alliances. So the first, around safety and security, is we are in an agreement, in a formal agreement with Secure Community Network, known as SCAN. They came to recognition after the hostage situation in Colleyville, Texas, in January, when the rabbi, after he escaped, said he credited SCAN and his local federation for the training he received to know when it was time to fight and run. So we are engaging with that organization that will not only train our community for situational awareness, train our staff, our professionals who work within the community with our most vulnerable seniors, children, to ensure that they know how to react and respond in a crisis. Mm-hmm. But we also want to harden our sights. We want to make it that much more difficult for someone to walk on campus that does not have good intentions. And we want to build relationships and continue to build the strong relationships that we have with the JSO, with the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, with the St. John's Sheriff's Office, and with the local FBI.
What are authorities telling you about these hateful messages and their investigation into them?
So it's frustrating, the fact, on one hand, this is what we love about America, freedom of speech. But in this particular situation, it's frustrating because they are under the rights of freedom of speech. There is no direct threat in their messages. However, we're not naive, all of us, to know that hateful words spur hateful actions. And so right now, they're suggesting that we don't retweet or continue to show images, but rather focus on building alliances, talking about the strength of the Jewish community, trying to discredit by fact some of the stereotype and wrongful lies mm-hmm. perpetrated by them. And that's what they're sharing with us right now.
Anti-Semitic incidents in the U.S. have been on the rise mm-hmm. for years, with nearly 3,000 tracked last year mm-hmm. across the country by the Anti-Defamation League. Mm-hmm. And, of course, people of the Jewish faith are incredibly concerned and worried, but not just people of the Jewish faith, mm-hmm. because hate towards one group can extend to other groups. This is a canary in the coal mine for yeah. the rise of a hateful tide of mm-hmm. Authoritarian white nationalist messaging. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. That falls under our second and our third pillar that I spoke about is building alliances. There's this wonderful poem that, you know, talked about, really related to the Holocaust, where it talked about they came for my neighbor and no one stood up for them. They came, et cetera, et cetera. And then they came for me and there was no one left to stand up mm-hmm. for me. And we have to learn from the lessons in the past. And I think anyone who wants to engage in a dialogue and wants to live in a community that is welcoming, tolerant, accepting of all race, religion, gender identity, want to sit down and want to work together, because we all believe, just like you said, hate breeds hate. Mm. And they're not going to stop at one community that's quote-unquote different than what they see of themselves. So we're working to build alliances and relationships with not just organizations like the ADL, mm-hmm. organizations like Stand With Us and our own Jewish Holocaust Museum that really focuses on education, but we want to build alliances with like One Jacks and other interfaith leadership.
We'll be hosting some interfaith leaders later in the week on this very topic as well. But first, if you're just tuning in this Monday morning, our guest in studio is Miriam Feast, CEO of the Jewish Federation and Foundation of Northeast Florida. As they work to combat hateful, vile, anti-Semitic messages that marred Florida Georgia Weekend in Jacksonville, let's go to your calls. Lily and Jax. Hi, Lily. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good Good morning. I just wanted to say, you know, as a proud Jacksonville resident, it makes me so upset to see this hatred messaging. And I think that it all really begins at home and the conversations we have with our children and the values that we want to put forth in our community. So thank you so much. And thank you for all the work that you do to shed light on this issue.
Thanks, Lily. What we say to our kids.
Right.
That matters.
Right.
This is a teaching moment for parents right now, isn't it? As awful as it is.
Absolutely. And there are so many resources available if parents don't feel comfortable having these conversations. I just mentioned a few of them. Between the Holocaust Museum, the Jewish Holocaust Museum here in town, with ADL, Stand With Us, and other faith leaders that can really help direct those conversations. There's a great organization also, the Jewish Students Union, that works in public schools. Of course, if you feed kids, they're going to come at their breaks, and really having a dialogue with kids of all different faiths.
Yeah, absolutely. Tom in NAS Jax. Hi, Tom. Good morning to you.
Good morning. And again, I'm the one who's going to say thank you for bringing up this topic. The previous caller was correct. We do have to teach our children. This is very important. However, we cannot forget that we also have to teach our neighbors. We have to teach our coworkers. We have to teach our spouses, our family and friends, people who feel completely free and entitled to espouse their hate, fear, and anger at everything and everybody. If it goes left undone because we don't want to start an argument, then it's okay. Then we quietly condone what they're doing. The only way for bad things to succeed, as everybody knows, is for good people and good things to do nothing. And that's what's been going on. Tell your neighbors, tell your family, tell your friends who espouse this hate, your other people at church, oh, by the way, when they espouse their hate, when they feel free to do so, that they're wrong and they must stop and reconsider this and pray about it.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for that. Doug in Miramar. Hello, Doug. How are you today? Go ahead.
Doing well. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
All right.
I wanted to thank you for having this discussion today. As a fourth-generation Jacksonville resident and someone who's Jewish and someone who's raising his children Jewish, what happened Friday was extremely disturbing. But I think I guess what I would like to say is I'd like to thank candidate Cumber and Councilwoman Cumber and Councilmember Carlucci for speaking out on it when it first happened. I was extremely disappointed to be labeled miserable because other elected leaders waited until it made national news. It wasn't significant enough that it happened to their residents, to their neighbors, to their friends. It was only significant because CNN, Rex Chapman on Twitter, and all these other outlets picked it up. And to me, as a resident, someone who's been actively involved in interfaith activities my entire life and throughout my family, that spoke volumes of where our city is as opposed to where it used to be. And I think it goes a lot to the nature of politics in this state, the nature of politics in this country. And I would just charge everyone who's listening, who has a friend that is different from them, to just simply imagine if the roles were reversed. Imagine if they had to go to their house of worship and know that it requires law enforcement to be outside of it, to be able to practice a faith that we allegedly are guaranteed under the Constitution. It's not easy to make this call. It's not easy to call out friends, but at some point it has to be enough. But I appreciate you for bringing the topic to light Friday and then also bringing light today, because light has to defeat darkness.
Thank you, Doug. Kate in the Rail Yard District. Hi, Kate.
Good morning. Good morning. Here we go again. Jacksonville making international news for all the wrong reasons. I am a member of Taken Down Jacks, and this is just another example of why we need to get these Confederate monuments down. And also, one of the most disturbing parts of this story is that our governor has not said anything about it. He was here in Jacksonville on Saturday, and there is no way he did not hear about the story Saturday night. That should have been the first thing he said when he was speaking to the press again.
Thanks, Kate.
Thank you.
The previous caller referenced Mayor Lenny Curry taking a long time to condemn these messages, and he seemed to be upset about that. We do need to note Mayor Curry did condemn them. Kate points out Governor DeSantis has yet to say a word about this, and he flip the coin at the game. What about that?
Well, I can't directly speak to why or what he is thinking. What I can speak to and reiterate what some of your callers stated, we cannot be silent during this time. Silence is another way of condoning the actions and the words and giving more credence. So I encourage everyone, as your callers have just said, to have conversations. Polite dialogue, respectful dialogue, agree to disagree in a way that you can have and engage in these conversations.
Lots of emails, tweets, calls. Our guest is Miriam Feast, CEO of the Jewish Federation. Stacy tweets the show, "This is a universal hate crime against every human being. I thank every brave person for speaking up against hate. Holocaust denial and lies must be met with truth. My upcoming documentary, Traces, premieres January 28th at the Wilson Center." That's about the Holocaust. Thank you for that. That's our book club leader tweeting the show, Stacy Goldring. Josh tweets the show, "The speaker raises a very important point. A lot of anti-Semitism is implicit. You might not see explicitly hateful statements against Jews, but there's a lot of rhetoric that trades on Jewish stereotypes that have been used to legitimize genocide." Hope tweets the show, "I'm involved in Holocaust education in our schools, and there has been a rise in anti-Semitic acts. This hate parallels a rise in anti-Black, anti-immigrant, anti-LGBTQ rhetoric that goes unchecked. We are in dangerous times," she says. Paul emails us with this comment, "The radical right has made it acceptable for some people to voice the hate they have always felt because the good people who condemn them are being drowned out in fear of personal attacks. It is unacceptable. We should not let this hate become commonplace." What do you think?
These are insightful words, and it encourages me to feel that people of all walks of life are feeling the same type of outrage and anger and are stating the same thing. We must talk about this. We must talk up. We must talk about it. We must have dialogue. And it's education, and it's building alliances and friendships.
Teresa in St. John's. Hi, Teresa. Good morning to you. Thanks for holding.
Good morning. I'm troubled by the message from some leaders in law enforcement not to retweet images or posts about what's been going on here, because as has been said, now is not the time to be silent.
All right. Let's talk about that. Because, you know, I have to tell you, a friend of mine sent me the image of the Nazi banners at I-10 in Chaffee Friday night.
Right.
I tweeted it out. I think that's more than anything I've ever put on Twitter in since 2008 when I joined Twitter. I think that got the most retweets of anything I've ever posted. Many thousands of retweets. And most of the people doing it were doing it to amplify this, to condemn it. So people want to condemn this. They want to help. And they're not sure how. What about her comment?
Look, I'm not law enforcement, but I understand what they're trying to share. There is a difference between retweeting. It's similar to a lot of these active shooter situations where the victims, the survivors and families of victims state that they don't want the names mentioned of the individuals who did this.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want the focus to be on the shooting. They want the focus on what do we do to stop this. And I think that's what they're saying about this. We're giving it more life by promoting the actual words and sites as compared to absolutely go to social media, absolutely go to your different outlets, go to your neighbors and have a conversation about how hate speech is wrong and should not be tolerated and breeds further hate speech and hate actions without actually displaying the words and the images.
It's so important that people get this, because this kind of speech leads to blood and death.
Correct.
That is why this is so important. It's not just a bunch of goofballs putting their sheets up over the highway. This incites violence. That is why it's so important as a community that we stand against it, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, there's two things. It takes time to have active dialogue and to make change. And there's the immediacy that our community is doing and we are forced to do. And I'm sure other faith communities are doing so too. And we must act with heightened security and awareness to protect our community. No one should be afraid to walk in to a place of worship. No one should be afraid to walk into a community center or any other social gathering because of their religion.
Miriam Feast is CEO of the Jewish Federation and Foundation of Northeast Florida, and I want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much. And again, I want to reiterate what others have said. Thank you for bringing this to the attention and having this conversation.
Certainly. And much more still ahead. Later, another heartbreaker. Yep, another one for the Jaguars, this time in London. But up next, new polling out this week on the city's sheriffs and mayor's races. We'll take a look after this. Welcome back. Well, new polling is out today in the city's closely watched sheriff's race and the mayor's race, too. We have a closer look as we welcome Mike Binder, president of the UNF Faculty Association. He also directs UNF's Public Opinion Research Lab. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good to see you. And give us a call as we talk about the latest polling in high-profile city races, 549-2937. Okay, so you polled on the sheriff's race. Early voting is already underway. And what are the results as you look at the contest between Lakeisha Burton, the Democrat, and T.K. Waters, the Republican?
We have it as close race. We have T.K. Waters up by 5, but it's 48-43. There's still a number of folks that haven't quite made up their minds, don't know which way they're going to go. So it's not out of reach. This is going to be a tight race. And I think, like always in Florida, it seems like turnout's going to be paramount.
And, of course, typically, Republicans have a better turnout game than Democrats in this state. That said, this is a race that has gotten some bipartisan crossover. Some Republicans saying they'll support the Democrats, some Democrats saying they'll support the Republican. And, you know, I don't know if you heard this, Mike, but the other day on the show, as we were discussing this race, one of the candidates, Lakeisha Burton, called into the show and said that her primary opponent, Ken Jefferson, asked her for a job. He said, "I'll endorse you if you make me the number two in the department." Burton claimed that she turned him down. WJCT News investigated it. Another chief witnessed this exchange and said it happened. A few minutes after Burton called in, Ken Jefferson called in and said, "No, that never happened." But the bottom line is both candidates sought his endorsement. He endorsed Waters, and he would not rule out going to work for Waters should Waters be elected when he called into this program. And so I'm just wondering how this latest wrinkle might affect the race and might affect votes, if at all.
Well, I mean, there is, you know, federal law that prohibits candidates from explicitly promising jobs for endorsements for candidates. So clearly, if this is true, and apparently there are witnesses that say that it is, you know, that's really a stain on Jefferson. And, you know, what that means going forward You know, I'm not sure, but I will say this, you know, thinking about what this means for the election, you know, one thing to keep in mind is a lot of the Democrats, a lot more Democrats in our poll were more undecided than Republicans. So if the Democrats come home to the Democrats, that leaves room for Lakeisha to tighten this up a little bit. But it also shows you, you know, there were four Democrats in the race in August, and there's only one Republican. So the Democrats haven't quite coalesced entirely around Lakeisha, although obviously most have.
Mm-hmm. 549-2937. Let us know who'll get your vote for sheriff. And the mayoral election is next spring. Let's talk about that for a little bit. There are quite a few candidates already in the field who have filed to run. What do the numbers show there?
I mean, it's not just that there's, you know, nine candidates that have filed to run. It's that there's quality candidates that have filed to run. Donna Deegan, she's in the lead just by virtue of her name recognition, having been on air and running the foundation that she's run. She has 22%. But there's other candidates with a lot of money, like a Daniel Davis and Councilwoman Leanna Cumber. You know, they're down at 6% and 7%. But the campaign hasn't started, and they have millions, plural, in the bank that's mm-hmm. going to come out. Mm-hmm. So the big thing is, I think that almost 50% of the people don't know who they're going to vote for, which makes a little bit of sense at this stage of the game.
But as you say, it takes money to introduce a candidate to a countywide audience. People forget how big this county is and how hard it is to win countywide and how much money you need.
And
there's resources.
There's diverse neighborhoods. This isn't just geographically, and there's not just, you know, a million people and all that stuff, but you know, the difference in a San Marco and a Northside and the beaches and Mandarin, they are wildly different mm-hmm. places, and you can't go knock on every single door. It's just not possible.
No, you need television. And of course, people right now, as they're going out to vote, are getting their mailboxes stuffed full of flyers. Some of them have misleading claims. What about that? Do those work?
They do to some extent.
You think
extent.
They work
now
still,
listen, it's
even
on,
today?
Everything's on the margins because the vast majority of folks know who they're going to vote for because it's a D or because it's an R. But there are people on the margins that can be moved, and there are issues that can move people too. You know, we'll see how much this Ken Jefferson kerfuffle breaks through. I'm not, you know, a lot of votes have already been cast. Let's be honest, a sheriff's race is not getting the most attention in this area. There's a governor's race and a Senate race and even, you know, races for Congress that, you know, that's another one that's on our poll. We polled on CD4. So there's a lot going on aside from just the sheriff's race.
Let's talk about CD4. That's Aaron Bean, the Republican, versus Democrat L.J. Holloway. And of course, that district is redrawn, gerrymandered, to really heavily favor the Republican.
Not only strongly favor the Republican, but also move a lot of the black vote into that district that used to be formerly CD5, Al Lawson's seat, before that, Corinne Brown's seat, et cetera, but surround it with a lot of white Republicans in Nassau and Clay counties and really put them at a tough spot to get a candidate elected.
We're speaking with UNF pollster Mike Binder. New polling on the sheriff's and mayor's races in the city. 549-2937. Janelle in Jacksonville. Hi, Janelle. Good morning.
Good morning. I was disturbed last Friday during the discussion about the candidates for sheriff. It was evident to me, even during the primary, that Ken Jefferson was against Lakeisha Burton. The only negative ads I saw during that time were put out by somebody supporting Ken Jefferson against Lakeisha Burton. And so it disturbs me that he is saying that he offered to support her.
Thank you, Janelle. Let's go over this again for people that weren't listening Friday. It was a wild hour of radio, to say the very least. Here's how it all went down. We had council member Randy DeFore in studio. She is a regular panelist. She'll be cycling off the council next June. She all but endorsed Lakeisha Burton on the air. And keep in mind, Ms. DeFore is a Republican. Burton is a Democrat, but Burton has won a number of high-profile Republican supporters. DeFore said she felt honesty and transparency were key in this election. as if to say she, what she seemed to be saying was that she felt Burton was the more ethical candidate. That was the tone of her comments. Then Lakeisha Burton called into the show unprompted as we talked about the Ken Jefferson endorsement of her opponent, T.K. Waters. Burton said that Jefferson wanted her to promise him the department's number two job if he would endorse her. She said she refused. She said she had a witness to this, Sheriff's Office Chief Andre Ayoub. He backed up her statements and said it did happen when he was contacted by WJCT News. Ken Jefferson then called into the show, by the way, as we were still discussing all of this, and said that none of this was true. He said his campaign manager would back up his version of events. I asked Jefferson if he was promised a job for endorsing T.K. Waters. He said no, but he also said he would consider a position in JSO if Waters offered it to him. So that's what happened, Mike.
Yeah, that's quite a development. And you have to wonder if you're outwardly saying, yeah, I would take a job. I'm looking for a job, that conversation wasn't had both ways.
Well, and let me ask you this too, because let's be clear. We know this kind of horse trading goes on in this town. It's typically done under the radar, a wink and a nod, nothing on paper. It happens a lot.
Sure.
This is one of those times when, allegedly, it spilled out into the public view.
Well, I think, and the caller brought this up, there was a lot of talk when Jefferson got into the race that it was on behalf of the Republican Party. It was solely to try and keep Lakeisha Burton out of a potential runoff. And, you know, that's a circumstance where if that were true, you know, maybe he should not have approached her at all in the first place. These are all things to think about on the backside. But yeah, a lot of this stuff goes on behind the scenes. None of it's good. It ought not occur. And mm-hmm. you know, we should expect more from our elected officials, I believe.
All right. And getting back to the mayor's race, which is, as you mentioned, not till 2023, we have a message from a listener. The 47% of voters still undecided is unusual, and it's a function of it being a phone poll. Voters try not to voice an opinion if they can get away with it by phone. What about that and how you poll?
Well, I'd say, except for the fact that 91% of respondents told us who they want to vote for the sheriff's race. And I'd follow that up with 88% of respondents told us who they wanted to vote for the CD4 race, and exactly the same poll.
I see.
This has to do with two factors. One, the mayor's race hasn't started yet. Yes, I know people have raised literally millions of dollars, and you're starting to see an ad here or there, but there's elections before that. There hasn't been a focus on it. Also, there are a number of Democrats and a number of Republicans that are quality candidates, right? Somebody like Adonna Deegan with name recognition, Audrey Gibson, who's been elected to statewide office, Leanna Cumbert, Daniel Davis, Al Ferraro, current council member, Omega Allens, who's run seemingly forever in this town. So all these people have real name recognition. So it's not surprising that people are undecided.
Anything else from these numbers that you want people to know about?
I think the big thing to be aware of is, and just, it's early. And we polled voters who we thought were likely to vote in November. The people that are likely to vote in March and potentially in May again are different. They tend to be older. They tend to be whiter. They tend to be more Republican. These are all things to keep in mind as we get closer to that election. If you want your voice heard, you got to show up. You know, 30% turnout that we get for these March elections simply isn't enough.
Mike Binder of UNF's Public Opinion Research Lab. Always great to have you. And love the new hair, by the way. For people who can watch this on our video stream, Mike's grown his hair out and it looks good. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, trick or treat, take your pick on this Halloween night. A chocolate-covered cricket? Maybe a waxworm caterpillar? Yeah, sounds spooky. Well, even though Halloween is the night we all enjoy eating candy, how about this? For some, it's an opportunity to take a little bite into creepy crawlers like crickets and grasshoppers. Can you believe this? Yeah, eating bugs has become more popular in this country because people are learning the benefits, the nutritional benefits of eating insects. Rebecca Baldwin is associate professor in the UF IFAS Department of Entomology and Nematology, and she's on the line with more. Hey, Rebecca, good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you. This is fascinating, but I have to say, on this Halloween, nothing scares me more than the thought of eating bugs. So why are people doing this?
Well, it's actually gaining more popularity in Western cultures than it ever has been before. People have eaten bugs since, 700 BC. There are documents of people eating insects. It's not so common in Western cultures. And students are finding out more and more about the benefits of eating insects and that they're actually not so bad. The thing that really piques their curiosity as you're going out trick-or-treating today, take a look at the labels. You'll actually realize that there are insect products already in your food, and they've been occurring there in the United States for more than 100 years. So we already eat bugs. Why not just embrace it?
Huh. How are we already eating bugs?
So we're eating insect products and insect fragments. So this time of year, everyone likes their pumpkin spice and likes their cinnamon. Well, if you take a half a cup of cinnamon, you're going to have about 400 insect fragments in that ground cinnamon. Cinnamon's just bark from a tree, and legally it's safe to have insect fragments in things like cinnamon. If you take a look at some of your trick-or-treat candy, things that are red or pink in color will have an all-natural, sustainable food dye called carmine, which comes as a secretion from a scale insect that's a sap feeder.
Wow.
So even some of your cosmetics will use that. Beeswax, as well as another product called confectioner's glaze, is used to make that shiny coating on your candies that you're eating to keep them from sticking from each other.
How interesting.
So look at those labels.
Look at the labels.
Confectioner's glaze, carmine, and just embrace the bugs.
Embrace the bugs. How are they good for you? What are the nutritional benefits?
Well, when you compare insect protein, insects have amino acids, they have protein, they have fiber. So the exoskeleton of an insect, not so digestible. So that's just considered fiber. But the inside parts of those insects have quite a bit of protein. So they're protein packed. And if you compare it to something like beef, a pound of crickets has over 1,200 calories. A pound of beef, just slightly less than 1,200 calories. So when you compare the two, insects are a more sustainable food source because they take less water and less area to produce. And they're actually considered to be micro livestock. So you could become an insect farmer yourself.
Wow. How interesting. How do you make insects to eat? What are recipes that people do?
Oh, my. There are actually cookbooks available online. And there's one from the 1800s that's been reprinted when there was an outbreak of grasshoppers in the United States. State governments shut down and asked people to pray over, the grasshoppers. Churches excommunicated grasshoppers, and some clever scientists said, well, why don't we just eat them? And in other countries, that's exactly what they do. When they have an infestation of grasshoppers, they go out and they eat them. They dry roast them. So you can dry roast them. You can fry them. You can bake them. You can grind them into flour and add them to things like your smoothies so you can add protein to them. You can make them sweet. You can make them savory. So they pick up a little bit of the flavor to whatever you want. So, it's fun to make, cinnamon sugar-coated crickets. And a lot of folks will actually make them holiday-themed. So, at Mardi Gras, you can have your king cake with sugar-dusted crickets on top.
Do you eat bugs?
Oh, of course.
What do you like to
eat?
How do you make them?
At my house. But I cook them for my students, and one of my favorites are waxworms. So you get those nice, fatty, sweet caterpillars, and you can make a dip out of just about any kind of fruit and eat them with crackers. So that's one of my favorite ways to cook them. In the class, we bring a griddle, and we take mealworms, and we cook them and put Cajun seasoning on them. So they're a little salty. So you can have your sweet, and you can have your salty. You can actually buy products online made with cricket flour. So you can buy tortilla chips made with cricket flour. You can buy chocolate brownies made with cricket flour.
Oh, my gosh. Now, when you do this in your classroom at UF and the students try out the insects, how do they typically react?
You have several groups. So you have some that totally embrace it as this interesting, sustainable food source. And then you have others that are just questioning. They want to know more. And once they start thinking about other arthropods they normally eat in their diet, like lobster and shrimp and crawfish, they're like, oh, wow, it's not that much different. One of my colleagues at Montana State says that, you know, grasshoppers are just land shrimp. So it's sometimes just about semantics on how you present things to other people.
Okay. It's Halloween. What advice do you have for people maybe wanting to check out insect cuisine on this spookiest night of all nights?
Well, there are some recipes available online that folks can check out. And like I said, there are cookbooks available online about eating bugs. But you can go to a pet store. Many pet stores and reptile shops sell insects as feeder foods and as fish bait. So you can actually purchase insects in bulk. You can freeze them. And my recommendation is to get rid of some of those legs, as once they're frozen, rub them through your hands to knock off some of those back legs that are mostly just the chitin. It would be like just eating the peel of an apple instead of eating the apple itself. So you can get rid of that excess chitin. And you can roast them in the oven and put whatever seasoning you want on them. And that makes a simple snack that's salty and crunchy.
Is
so
taking the leg,
mealworms, wax worms, those are the ones that are the most common to find in the United States.
And is taking the legs off helpful to kind of get rid of the ick factor some people might have?
Yes, and if you order things like chapulines from Mexico, for example, they sell them when before they become adults. So they're just the nymphal stage, so they don't have wings, and they also remove the legs. So it gets rid of that extra fiber that you don't really need in your diet.
There you go, folks. Check it out. Eating insects, it's a thing now. Rebecca Baldwin, happy Halloween. She's an associate professor in the UF IFAS Department of Entomology and Nematology. Fascinating. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much. Enjoy those buggy snacks this afternoon.
And in a moment, another heartbreaking loss for the Jaguars. Once again, near the end of the game, this time they went down in London. Josh Torres with that after this.
Announcing Vickers Landing at Oak Bridge, bridging retirees with an all-new Ponte Vedra Beach community featuring new homes, a resort lifestyle, and a life plan for every stage of aging. Information at vickerslanding.com.
Lee & Kate's Glass, family-owned and operated for 95 years. Lee & Kate's Glass is your source for upgrading your home's glass, from shower doors and mirrors to windows and tabletops. Learn more at leeandkatesglass.com.
WJCT and Vistar Credit Union are honoring the memory of Fred Rogers by celebrating 20 years of giving back to the community with the annual Mr. Rogers Sweater Drive. The drive runs through November 30th and accepts new and gently used sweaters, jackets, blankets, and new socks and underwear. Contributions may be dropped off at WJCT and all Vistar Credit Union branches, Suddeth Moving and Logistics, and the Tom Bush family of dealerships. For more information, log on to WJCT.org. Contributions will be donated to selected nonprofit facilities within the First Coast area.
I'm Robin Young. Before she faced a court-martial for revealing government documents, Chelsea Manning had a drunken dad who beat her for ridiculous slights.
Yeah, he said, you don't pay rent here. You know, I was just like, I'm in fifth grade. And the thing was, I was doing homework. My father pulled out the shotgun. I ran away.
Chelsea Manning's backstory, next time, here and now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
Early voting records are being set across the country.
It was a very good experience. People were friendly.
More than a million people have cast their ballots in Georgia alone. 1A listener Peter in Boca Raton summed up his feelings.
I did vote early and thrilled to be doing it.
Next time, how will early voting impact what we know before the midterms and when we'll know who's really won?
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, the Jaguars followed their usual script in week 8, losing 21-17 to the Denver Broncos in London. And once again, they blew a lead in the fourth quarter. Josh Torres is here now in studio. This makes it 5 in a row for the Jaguars, Josh.
Yes, it does, Melissa. It is just, it's frustrating. I mean, everybody in the organization, all the fans are all very, very frustrated with how this has gone, especially because the games are close and it's within reach, and all they need to do is just get that one score and they could come out with a victory. And a very, very interesting fact I saw yesterday during the game was that in the first and third quarters, so coming out of the locker rooms, the Jags, as of yesterday, obviously it may have changed now, led the league in scoring differential. So they outscored opponents during the first and third quarter and they were better than any other team. But then you get to the second, fourth quarters, they were second to last. So one of the biggest things they can't do is close games out. Mm-hmm. And you need that. Like, you have to have that. You need to follow that momentum. So it seems like when they're coming out of the locker room, they're coming out hot. They're looking good. But then as soon as it starts to get further and further into the game, guys start to tire out. A lot of other things start to happen, and they just fall off. And that is where they are losing, is during the second and fourth quarters, because they allow their opponents to get back into the game. They can go up by 2 touchdowns all they want, but if in the second quarter the same opponent scores 2 touchdowns of their own, now it's tied. And so you have to keep that momentum going, and that is really where they lost it yesterday, was they came out hot. They looked real good. They've got a nice 10-0 lead against a very struggling Broncos offense, and they just slowly let them get back into the game. Broncos eventually took the lead. Jags were able to take it back. And then finally the Broncos scored that game-winning touchdown. And then, again, as we've seen before, Trevor Lawrence gets the ball in his hands and unfortunately throws an interception to seal the game. Now, to his credit, it was a fantastic defensive play. Defender read the play, hook, line, and sinker, undercut the route, got the interception. So it's not entirely on Trevor's fault, but still, it's getting to a little bit of the point where I think a lot of people are concerned. Can we trust Trevor Lawrence when the game's on the line and we put the ball in his hands? Are we going to be able to trust him to actually give us a win? And with how some of these games have gone, that is a good question to ask, because right now I've looked at that and gone, would I trust him? Mm. And I really, really want to. All season, I've tried to give him the benefit of the doubt with everything that happened last year with Urban Meyer and the turmoil that was going on within the organization itself, and have really tried to give him a pass for everything that's happening this year, because essentially now a lot of people have almost considered this his rookie year because of the fact that he had to deal with all that last year. Now he's finally got a good coach, a much better structure around him. But we're still seeing a lot of those mistakes, and so there is a lot of work to be done before they can really snap this losing streak and get out of it.
Well, the trade deadline is approaching, so what can we expect, do you think?
It's interesting. You know, last week they traded James Robinson. Obviously, it was a Cinderella story, undrafted, rushed for 1,000 yards his rookie year, had injuries last year, was infamously benched by Urban Meyer after fumbling. And Trevor Lawrence actually had to go up to him and say, hey, why isn't he in the game? Like, you need to put him back in the game. And he was traded to the Jets. And that, you know, freed up Travis Etienne to be the number one guy, which is great. Honestly, he really showed yesterday that he deserved to be the number one guy. But it's interesting because I feel like they have a lot of the pieces that they need. So I don't expect them to be buyers. I don't expect them to be really calling people to try and make trades. But one name I have heard kind of tossed around was Josh Allen. And so we might see him on the block, but it'll be very interesting to see. But I definitely don't expect them to be buyers and trying to desperately get pieces right now. They might look to ship off some pieces to get some, maybe some draft capital.
Paul in St. John says, tell Josh we have to be close to a lock on the first pick in the draft, a record third in a row. We're number one.
Yep, we are
at least in something.
We are currently fighting, I think, about two other teams for that number one overall draft pick. I really wish I didn't have to say that, but we definitely are in that hunt.
All right. Last but not least, we led the hour with discussion of the anti-Semitic hate messages that were projected onto TIAA Bank Field and other places during the Florida-Georgia weekend. Lots of fans might not have even known that that was going on. They were just here for the game.
Yep. It was a great atmosphere. It was terrible to have to see that, to know that was going on, and especially to see it on the video board. That was absolutely horrendous. But overall, the weekend was great. It's always a fun atmosphere. There's a lot of great people who do come out to this game. There's actually a person that we have seen several times, older gentleman who parks in our parking lot. He comes by himself, and he just brings stuff out for everybody, and he just invites people to hang out. You know, he doesn't, and that's one of the great atmospheres that does go on during the game, is it's just a place for people to have fun and support their teams. Mm-hmm. This game, dominated by Georgia, 42-20 win, and then as we've heard over the past week, it's up in the air whether or not the game will continue. They have a contract through next year with an option through 2025, but there's been a lot of discussion of whether or not the game will continue past next year.
Where would they go?
They would want to play it in Athens and Gainesville. They would switch between the two. Kirby Smart, coach of Georgia, has been an outspoken opponent of the game being played in Jacksonville, so it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
All right. Well, Josh Torres, always with us to talk sports on Mondays. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks also to our team, David Luckin, Heather Schatz, Isabella Da Silva, and Michelle Corum, all helping get this show on the air every morning. And you, your feedback is what drives this thing. Drop me a line anytime at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Melissa Ross. Make it a great Monday. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.